Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Mankind in its present state has been around for a quarter of a million years, yet only the last 4,000 have been of any significance. So what did we do for nearly 250,000 years? We huddled in caves and around small fires, fearful of things that we didn't understand. It was more than explaining why the sun came up. It was the mystery of enormous birds with heads of men and rocks that came to life. So we called them gods and demons, begged them to spare us, and prayed for salvation.
In time, their numbers dwindled and ours rose. The world began to make more sense when there were fewer things to fear. Yet, the unexplained can never truly go away, as if the universe demands the absurd and impossible. Mankind must not go back to hiding in fear. No one else will protect us, and we must stand up for ourselves. While the rest of mankind dwells in the light, we must stand in the darkness to fight it, contain it, and shield it from the eyes of the public, so that others may live in a sane and normal world.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Christian Sager, and we are on our third episode about creepypastas. This, I want to say it was this time last year that we did the first one, and people really liked it. So we did a second one. And then I would say, especially this time of year, we get about an email or two a week suggesting different creepypastas that we read and possibly do on the show. And the one that we have been hearing about the most is called SCP. And we looked into it and it fit the show perfectly. It's almost like they designed it just for us. So I hope that the creators of SCP, the writers of these various creepypastas, are out there listening. We love what you're doing.
Yeah, SCP Foundation. SCP stands for Special Containment Procedures. And you can find this, by the way, at scp/wiki.wikidot.com, or just do a web search for SCP Foundation, or we'll also include a link to it on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous, just a catalog, encyclopedia of all these weird specimens that are presented as if they are under scientific scrutiny, as if these specimens are being, investigated. very cautiously by individuals who have scientific curiosity about the specimens, but also the best interests of mankind and its sanity at heart.
Yeah, they pitch it as being kind of like that TV show Warehouse 13, but mm-hmm. what I thought more of was, spoilers, Cabin in the Woods. And what's going on behind the scenes in that movie. So, okay, maybe you have never heard one of our creepypasta episodes before, so we're going to give you a real quick intro to it, although I recommend that you go check out the ones that we've done previously. Creepypastas are viral copy and paste text in the form of horror stories. They evolved from copypasta, which is another sort of viral copy and paste text thing. They take the shape of urban legends, mainly appearing as if they're something that actually happened. And they mimic first-person accounts, especially scientific ones, which is why we're attracted to them, because we like to, on these episodes, take the scientific ones and kind of extrapolate out what's actually going on here science-wise. So we have a penchant for this genre. The most popular one that you've probably heard of is Slender Man. Now, the genre really seems to have hit its peak in 2010, but it is still chugging along as SCP is total evidence of.
Oh, yeah, there's a new television series.
That's right.
Sci-fi, right.
Yeah, in fact, Robert and I just did an interview with Playboy magazine, of all places, about this upcoming sci-fi TV show, Channel Zero, that's all about different creepypastas. And I guess the first one that they're going to do is Candle Cove. They're basically going to take some of these creepypastas and adapt them for television.
Yeah, I haven't seen it myself yet, but I've heard great things.
Yeah, me either. But back to SCP. So the basic idea here is that it's a foundation that is trying to contain and protect us from all these various entities that are sort of weird horror abstractions, right? Is that fair?
Yeah, and it's, I think it's kind of, I see SCP Foundation as kind of an evolution of the form, because the more classic examples of pasta and creepypasta, they're such, I mean, they straddle fiction and reality in such a way that you're supposed to misinterpret them. Like, it's the kind of thing where someone is pasting it onto a message board, like an individual saying, hey, has anyone ever had a bad experience with this medication?
Yeah.
And then someone pastes, as in copy and paste, pasta.
Yeah.
They paste this ridiculous story of something that happened to somebody, and then you're supposed to potentially think it's real.
Right, right.
Whereas SCP Foundation, it's not so much, they're not really pushing this is real, this really happened angle, but they're playing with the genre. They're still, I believe, anonymous entries.
I think so, yeah. They basically are cataloging all of these creatures, entities, whatever they are, as if they're all in containment.
Right.
And so the guidelines for writing one of these is that the article should have an interesting idea, a reasonable containment procedure for whatever it is that's being contained, and a clear description of each entry. They also operate on a rating system, which was really nice for us to be able to get like a good dive in. If the page is low rated, they're deleted from the site if they receive a -9 rating or lower. So these people are very focused on quality, more so than a lot of the creepypasta sites that we've been to before. There's also a spin-off game. I haven't had a chance to play it yet, but it's called Containment Breach, where you play a disposable human guinea pig that's stuck in the facility and it undergoes a containment breach. So you're alone with all the escaped entities. I just really liked a lot of these. They play to the weirdness of horror rather than to the gore of some of the creepypastas. And I that appealed to me.
Yeah, I mean, I also love the emphasis on humor and absurdity. There's still plenty of unsettling aspects to the various specimens.
Yeah.
But more often than not, the entries put a smile on my face or even elect a giggle.
Yeah.
Plus, there's a fair amount of variety in the style. Most of the top entries retain that case report format. But there are tone shifts here and there, and some rely on visuals more so than others. There's even one entry, at least, SCP-2521. That's entirely, it's told entirely through visuals, through the sequential use of like industrial hazard signs to tell the story of a deadly, but perhaps loving shadow entity that creeps in and terrifies and potentially, consumes, one of the researchers.
Yeah, I really love the creativity on this site. Definitely recommend that you go visit it. So our mission today on this episode is we each took three of our favorite specimens and then we extrapolated out scientific lessons that we can learn from them.
Yeah, so view it as a celebration of SCP Foundation materials, but also using the different examples from SCP as a stepping stone to then discuss some equally fascinating and weird science, real world science behind the fiction.
Okay, so we're going to start off with one of Robert's, and this one is called The Sculpture.
Yeah, this one's pretty cool because it not only is the idea interesting, it's also the original specimen. This was the first Foundation specimen to have a write-up. And I'm just going to read from the description. Quote, move to Site 19, 1993. Origin is of yet unknown. It is constructed from concrete and rebar with faces of Krylon brand spray paint. SCP-173 is animate and extremely hostile. The object cannot move while within a direct line of sight. Line of sight must not be broken at any time with SCP-173. Personnel assigned to enter a container are instructed to alert one other before blinking. Object is reported to attack by snapping the neck at the base of the skull or by strangulation. In the event of an attack, personnel are to observe Class 4 hazardous object containment procedures.
So, a lot of these remind me of, like, the premises for Doctor Who episodes.
Yes.
And this one immediately made me think of the Weeping Angels, which are sort of a favorite on the newer Doctor Who episodes.
Yeah, indeed. Like, this is the trope, right? The entity that cannot move as long as you're looking at it. But if you look away, it's going to creep in with alarming speed.
Yeah.
Another big example of this are the hedge creatures from Stephen King's novel The Shining.
Oh, yeah. That's right. One of the things, Shining movie is my favorite movie of all time, but that is the one thing from the novel I really wish had made it in there.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because in the movie, the original Kubrick film, we got this hedge maze.
Yeah.
And certainly that works very well within that adaptation.
Yeah.
But in the original novel, there are these hedge animals. And if you look away, then you look back and they move closer and get closer and closer.
And I haven't seen it yet, but Stephen King made his own adaptation of it. And I believe the hedge creatures are in that.
I think so. I think they kept it, but I've not seen that
one of either. These days I'll get to it.
Now SCP-173, as the picture seems to illustrate, is kind of this giant space baby from a Jan Svankmajer film.
The image is pretty crazy.
It's a little bit bad, but it's also it's creepy to look at,
because you're
trying to imagine this thing moving when your eyes are averted.
And I believe this is also the most popular one, right?
I think it's right up there on the top of the list, if not the most popular. And certainly it's been around the longest.
Yeah.
And it is a really good like template for I imagine for anyone creating one of these. Now, in addition to the head creatures from Stephen King's The Shining and the Weeping Angels from Doctor Who, which as you pointed out, these on the show were ancient alien predators who resemble winged humans, and they make use of time paradoxes. So they move swiftly, but only if nothing is looking at them.
Yeah.
And apparently if two Weeping Angels look at each other at the same time, they get trapped in their stone forms.
Yeah.
But then on top of these fictional examples, there's Ninja Cat from YouTube. Have you seen these?
I don't know what this is.
It's exactly the same premise.
So
somebody pointing their camera at this cat that's peeking around a corner at them down the hallway.
It's a real cat, not a cartoon.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the camera moves away for a second, moves back, and the cat is peeking around a closer corner, and they move away, and then when they come back, the cat is even closer. But just like the hedge creatures or the Weeping Angels or this particular SCP specimen, you never actually see it move. It just gets closer and closer and closer until it's right on you.
Wow. No, I haven't seen that one, but that sounds like it would be very amusing.
Yeah. It is. It's wonderful. But this last example, Ninja Cat, given that it's a natural world predator as opposed to an otherworldly one, it raises the question, does direct line of sight, direct eyesight even, protect a prey animal, such as a human, from a predator, such as a tiger or a weeping angel or a hedge monster? Yeah. It's a wonderful question, and indeed we have some answers to that. So eye contact is, of course, something that creepily transcends species, and I mean it's creepy enough with humans, right?
Yeah,
it's weird. Two humans lock gazes, and there's this sense of connection, sense of openness, or an attempt to dominate. Numerous studies have revealed that it has various influences over trust, persuasion. A 2011 study even showed that eye contact can serve as an invitation to mimicry, which which has an impact on the way we learn, but also potentially on how people with autism struggle to grasp when they are expected to copy the actions of another person.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, certainly. I mainly think of the sort of, quote, science of eye contact because I used to teach public speaking, and mm-hmm. it's a big part of that. Like, how much eye contact should you have with your audience? Where should you be moving your eyes through the audience? Should you just stare at one person? Obviously not. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of rules to it to be an effective public speaker.
Right. But related to that, there's also this mix of a continuing study into how, direct eye contact influences our speaking abilities.
Yeah.
But also there's a fair amount of sort of folk mythology about as well.
Yeah.
For instance, the whole idea that you should make direct eye contact when trying to convince somebody of something.
Yes.
Be it in a speech or whatever. There was actually a 2013 University of Freiburg study that found that direct eye contact makes skeptical listeners less likely to change their minds.
Yeah, I believe it.
So it's like, oh, you're boring into me with your ideas and your creepy eyes. I'm just going to shut you out.
I remember, I don't have them in the notes here, but I remember reading studies that like have quantified the exact amount of seconds that human beings can look at each other in the eyes before it becomes so uncomfortable that they just immediately shut down. Yeah.
But the crazy part though, right, is that if you've ever made eye contact with a dog or a cat or a zoo animal,
yeah.
then you felt that interspecies connection as well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That's funny that you bring that up because, you know, I have two dogs. I hang out with them all the time and, look them in the eyes all the time. A lot longer than a human and I would be able to look each other in the eyes. But I think it's because the dogs are connecting differently, but it still means something to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I have the same experience with our cat who I know, you know, I do not, this cat especially, I do not anthropomorphize too much.
Right.
Like she's a monster who attacks my feet.
Yeah.
And, it just came around at the wrong point in our lives. I mean, I love her. She's wonderful, but she's kind of a wreck.
Both my cats are similar.
But you make eye contact with them and it's like, oh, it's like I know that we have totally different minds and totally different brains,
yeah.
totally different views of the world. And yet right now we're sharing this profound connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
You're staring into eyes and you have no word for eyes. Oh, you can just go down the rabbit hole on it.
Yeah.
But at the basic, right, like the bedrock here is that when two creatures make eye contact, there's this idea that one has been seen, that one is being seen, that one is, you're not hiding from that other creature. The other creature is aware. And then what comes next?
Mm-hmm.
So there are two main distinctions in what should come next. First, matching up with the idea of the weeping angels and topiary animals and SCP-173, there's this reality that certain creatures depend on stealth to acquire their prey. And if they know that you see them, that is going to take away their advantage. They are stealth hunters. They are surprise predators. And if they don't have that surprise, then they may back off.
Mm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I can't help but think of these attacks in XCOM terms.
Oh, okay. Yeah, video games. I was immediately thinking of video game, different video game, but mm-hmm. yeah, when you're trying to sneak up on somebody.
Yeah, or D&D as well, where you have a bonus, right. There's a damage bonus or an attack bonus to a sneak attack.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in video games, like, yeah, if it's a video games role playing, if the stakes are high enough, that surprise attack can make all the difference.
Right.
But you know, within the game, it's still a game, right? Well, for predators, it's even more important because, first of all, nothing beats a sure thing, right? Or even a near sure thing. If an attack does not go as exactly planned, a number of consequences can occur. So the prey might get away, in which case you've lost energy, you've lost time. Other prey in the area might be alerted to your presence and they're frightened away. Worse still, an alert prey animal could have the chance to counterattack and inflict damage. And that kind of injury can prove deadly. Cheetahs, for instance, rarely go after larger prey like an ostrich. There are some very interesting examples where they do develop strategies to do that. But for the most part, they don't, because while the payoff for catching that ostrich is wonderful, if they get injured, it basically can mean starvation because they are a high-speed predator and a limping cheetah is not going to eat.
Yeah, this reminds me of a video that I shot here for work a couple weeks ago about killer whales and humpback whales.
Uh-huh.
There's a similar thing going on in that killer whales try to sneak up and take out humpback whale calves, but now humpback whales have started to fight back, to the point that humpback whales will actually interfere with killer whale attacks on other animals. Like, they're saving seals from, killer whale attacks. And this, go watch the video, but there's a lot of science to it, trying to figure out what's going on there. Exactly to this point, the killer whales are expending all this energy, and then the humpbacks just basically pummel them down, to make sure that they stay away. And they're basically teaching them a lesson, like, yeah, don't go after our children.
Yeah. And certainly I have a hard time, sympathizing with the mammal eating killer whales.
Yeah. Of course, they gotta eat somehow, yeah, but yeah.
That's true. But then you have the fish eating killer whales.
Yeah.
Where, in my household, my 4-year old is very into nature right now, and he likes killer whales, but he's very firm that he only likes fish eating.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah.
Despite the fact that there's a particular, to tie back into viewing prey, killer whales that prey on seals will do this thing called spy hopping.
Oh.
And my son's very intrigued by that. And this is where they'll poke their heads out of the water and kind of like peek over the top and see what their prey is up to.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe if that seal just made direct eye contact with the killer whale, it would swim away.
Yeah, that's right. Now, that's one possibility, right?
Right.
If you know that a predator is after you, just make eye contact with it at all times. It's great, but that's going to be quite a resource drain. You can't constantly be on the lookout for predators. So the next best tactic, or perhaps the better tactic, is to fool your enemies into thinking someone's watching you all the time. And we actually see countless examples of this in the evolution of eye spots across various species. So these are just, dots on a creature that look like eyes. Now, to be clear, not all eye spots are there to mimic watching eyes. Sometimes they're there to fool a predator into attacking a less vulnerable part of the animal. You know, don't attack my head, attack my rump.
Right.
Or they play into mate selection. But in some cases, yes, eye spots definitely serve as anti-predator adaptations. And we also see examples of the strategy's effectiveness outside of natural adaptation. For instance, in India, you have individuals who happen to live and work in Bengal tiger country, and they've long reported success with these wooden human masks that they wear on the back of their heads.
Oh, yeah.
With wide open eyes. That the idea here is that the tiger will try and stealth attack them, but it sees this face staring back at them.
Mm.
And so they realize, oh, well, my percentage to hit is less. I'm not going to take the risk. various animal species have evolved eye spots that in many cases may serve to protect them from creeping predators, as I already mentioned. Currently, there's this really cool project. Australian conservation biologist Dr. Neil Jordan is experimenting with the use of painted-on eye spots, painted in just black paint, onto grazing cattle. And the idea here is to protect them from lion attacks, because lions end up attacking cattle, and then the humans counterattack, at least all this violence, and then the lions are already endangered anyway. It's a bad situation for everyone. So far, he has reported a fair amount of success with this. So he holds a position with the Botswana Predator Conservation Trust, and he recently held a 10-week trial of the strategy, painting eyes on 1/3 of a 62 cattle herd. 3 unpainted cows wound up as lion chow, but none of the eye cows fell to predation.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't we do a Now video on this? Was it you who hosted that one? Okay. Yeah. So,
which is why it's fresh
in your mind. Yeah. I remember this from a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, we have a small video out there that you can go check out at How Stuff Works Now.
They're going to do a follow up on it.
And,
hopefully we'll see the results of that in the weeks and months ahead. But, they're going to use, GPS cattle trackers, et cetera, to really see how effective this strategy is.
Mm.
But it does drive home the fact that, yes, there are predatory creatures where if they know that you're watching, they will back off, or they will hold off their attack. However, that doesn't mean the direct eye contact with your specimen is always a good thing. There are also plenty of examples where it will force violent actions out of the other species. I mean, essentially, you're making eye contact with another animal. If they might see you as prey, they're going to hold off their attack. But if they think that you are the predator, they think you might be the aggressor, they may just go ahead and counterattack.
Mm-hmm.
So dogs, for instance, They key into human eye movements. There have been a number of studies about this. They're able to track our eye movements and infer intent. And this has also been documented in other species, primates, goats, dolphins, seals, even some tortoises. But of course, dogs that feel especially threatened can actually be provoked into attacking via eye contact. And I imagine anyone who's ever spent a lot of time around dogs, especially if you're around a dog that, you know, is nervous, is already feels threatened. Mm-hmm. Like you, most adults, I think, know not to just go and like get in its face and stare at it.
Right. Yeah.
However, according to a 2007 New Zealand Medical Journal report, this actually can also be one of the reasons that young children are the ones who are often victims of dog attacks when you have one of these threatened animals. I mean, on one hand, yes, the child is going to be smaller, more on the dog scale.
Yeah.
There's more of a possibility for more grievous injuries because of the attack. But also they say that a child is going to be less likely to avert their gaze.
Okay. So this is like the Cujo lesson of science, right? Like Cujo is a different situation, but I can't remember back to that book or the movie if there's points where they just make direct eye contact with it.
Yeah, I don't recall it either.
Yeah. But now, but there's a kid, right? It's the mom and the kid.
Yeah, they're like stuck in a car, I think. I never read or saw it, so I can't comment too much on Cujo. However, I did see the movie Congo, in which there are a number of human-gorilla interactions.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, a well-known case as well. Like if you encounter a gorilla in the wild, don't make direct eye contact with it because you're going to enrage it.
Right, right.
And this is actually, you know, pretty well proven. In fact, back in 2007, the Rotterdam Zoo engaged in a wonderful reversal of the aforementioned tiger fooling masks. They gave all these visitors to the zoo shades, like little paper shades that look like averted eyes.
Oh.
So they're super goofy looking because.
Oh yeah, there's pictures here in our notes. Wow. Okay. So it looks like you're looking the other direction, but you're looking straight at the gorilla. So that the gorilla doesn't, run toward the glass
barrier?
Yeah,
because people were, you know, you're there to see the gorilla. You stare at the gorilla, and if the gorilla stares back and sees you staring, then it's going to enrage the gorilla. It's going to upset the animal, et cetera. So even discounting actual human-gorilla physical interaction, you don't want these creatures to be disrupted more than they already are
in
this artificial environment.
Yeah, especially in the wake of the whole Harambe incident. This seems like something that would make a lot of sense for most zoos to implement.
Yeah, but I will, to go back to SCP-173, would not make sense, I think, to wear these in the presence of that specimen.
Okay.
Because that would mean, even though you are making direct eye contact with it, it thinks you are not, and it might attack and strangle you.
Yeah, it seems like what you should do with SCP-173 is paint your body or your clothes with eyeballs all over it that are pointing directly forward.
Yeah,
so just in case you blink, it still thinks that you're looking at it.
Yeah, I would imagine that would be a decent addition to the
containment procedures. Yeah, cool. All right, well, the first one that I have is SCP-87, and it is also referred to as the stairwell.
Ooh.
The entity itself is just a platform staircase of 13 steps that has a platform in the middle that rotates 180 degrees to another staircase, right? So it's two staircases, like we know from like apartment buildings.
Uh-huh.
But the bottom one just leads into total darkness. And after 1.5 flights of stairs, the staircase limits your visual range. Even if you bring a light source with you, it won't always work. In fact, any light source that's over 75 watts has its excess light absorbed by the stairwell.
Ooh.
Subjects have reported hearing distressed children when they're on the stairs, below the initial platform and on into the darkness. And the staircase's depth seems to be unmeasurable and infinite. So it reminds me of House of Leaves.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Sometimes, however, explorers who have gone, you know, very far down the stairs, they all of a sudden run into a face with no pupils, no nostrils, and no mouth. So it just kind of pops up. It's like the jump scare of this, of the stairwell.
Okay.
Doesn't seem to hurt people. It just goes boop. And then
it sounds like something you would encounter in a Miyazaki film.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it does. It looks like it too. Yeah. They have a little image on the SCP-87 page. So, all right. This one fascinated me. and made me think about light absorption and want to understand a little bit more about how it worked so I could try to extrapolate out maybe what's going on with this staircase.
Okay. Because again, it is a staircase that goes to a lightless darkness that may be haunted and possibly inhabited by a weird Miyazaki creature.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So what's the deal? How is light absorbed? Well, the way that light is absorbed can be used to identify different types of gas in space because atoms and molecules absorb it at specific wavelengths. So how the spectra of light is absorbed can tell us a lot about the energy levels of the atoms and molecules that we're observing or about the number that are present. So perhaps this staircase has some unique attributes regarding its atomic structure. Let's consider atoms for a second to try to figure this out. They've got a positively charged nucleus that's made up of protons and neutrons, and they're orbited by negatively charged electrons. Usually, the number of protons and electrons are equal, so the atom has a neutral charge. Now, I'm going to skip a lot of physics here, okay? There was a lot to read about this, and I think it's over my head, and I don't want to bore our audience. But if an atom has energy added to it that can excite it by removing an electron, this is a process called ionization. And excitation is temporary, though when the atom drops back to its ground state, it gives off excess energy, which is usually light. Okay, so this is how light can be generated.
Okay.
Each atom emits a unique fingerprint on the light spectrum. And so that's how we're able to identify these different gases based on their atomic structure, what elements they might be. Now, visible light is a type of electromagnetic radiation. Light is composed of photons. And photons are just packets of energy that move at the speed of light. But if they're stopped, they cease to exist. So if a photon strikes an atom, it can give up its energy under the right circumstances. And in this process, the photon ceases to exist and the electron gets excited. This is absorption. This is when light gets absorbed, okay? Absorption occurs at specific energies in specific wavelengths. And this is how we identify these gases that light is passing through in space. Depending on what they are, certain wavelengths will be removed from the light, which results in dark lines. That's what they're referred to within the spectrum. So let's apply this to SCP-87. Again, this feels like a Doctor Who episode to me, like this creeping darkness and they're trying to figure out how to get past it. So I looked into the math of figuring out how many photons are emitted per second by a 75-watt bulb. It's possible to figure this out as a chemistry problem. That's beyond our scope here. I'm not going to walk all the way through the math, but I found someone else who did the answer for us, and I think it's 3.11486E+19 photons per second. So, based on what we know about light absorption on the atomic level, it sounds like the stairwell has some kind of element in it. Maybe it's a gas that absorbs photons above that level of 3.11486E+19.
Okay.
Then something changes about the stairwell's atoms so they no longer absorb light and they create dark lines in the spectrum. Maybe the electrons in this darkness area are just returning to their ground state, or is there something altering the wavelength of light as it's entering this area? So another possibility is the Doppler effect. This is the phenomenon of a shift in the frequency or wavelength of light caused by motion at its source, right? So this can shift the spectrum towards blue or red ends, creating different hues within light. And it doesn't seem likely to me that this is the case because it would mean, first of all, that there's something in the stairwell that would be moving the light source. You'd think you'd be aware of that. Maybe it's the distressed children or the Miyazaki monster, but you don't seem to see it at that point. The other reason is even if blue and red were shifted, you'd still have visible light from the remaining photons. This seems to create total darkness.
So based on what you've said so far, it sounds like the best case here is some sort of gas.
Yeah.
Combined with maybe some sort of metamaterial that's coating the structures itself themselves?
I think so, yeah. I think that's my best guess at what is going on here with the stairwell. Now, regarding the weird face and the sound of the distressed child and the infinite stairwell, I'm at a total loss. My best guess there is maybe because the stairwell is infinite, the generated photons from the light source can't reach its end, mm-hmm. even at light speed, because it's infinite. But I'm not sure. My best guess, though, is what you just said, that there's something going on with the amount of photons that are generated per second, and how much can be absorbed by whatever material is in there. So this stairwell is generating something, a field, some kind of gas.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left, look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, Robert's got another one here, and if you have also listened to our Frankenstein episode that's been released this week, this will be familiar. It is the homunculus.
Yes, and I'm going to try not to repeat myself on the two episodes too much here. So if you have any questions remaining about homunculi, tune in to our Frankenstein episode as well. So this is SCP-30. And here's the description. SCP-30 appears as a hairless, genderless, grave-toned human, 71 centimeters, 28 inches in height, and weighing 12.70 kilograms, 2 British stones in antiquated measure. Its solid blue eyes lacked discernible irises or pupils and resemble small cut sapphires. SCP-30 possesses an androgynous voice with a pronounced English accent not currently identifiable as specific to any modern region. It is able to converse, read, and write in ancient Greek, Latin, Italian, English, Spanish, and Portuguese, as well as 2 additional languages that have not yet been identified, despite SCP-30's insistence that they should be, quote, common knowledge. SCP-30 also demonstrated knowledge of physics, chemistry, astronomy, mathematics, and horticulture, roughly equivalent to that of a 17th century academic. In addition, SCP-30 has demonstrated knowledge of these topics along research lines that do not appear in the historical record. These alternative or entirely unknown approaches to research in the natural sciences are one source of SCP-30's utility in consultation.
Okay, so this immediately reminds me, you know, the Hellboy universe, right?
Oh, yes, with Norman the Homunculus.
Roger.
Roger.
Roger, it, yes. Yeah, it immediately makes me think of Roger the Homunculus, which if anybody out there is not familiar with Hellboy in that universe, there's the BPRD, which is very much like the SCP, actually.
Yeah.
Roger is one of their discoveries, but he's also an agent.
Yeah.
And he's a homunculus.
Yeah, and that's what we have here in SCP-30, a homunculus that does seem to have a level of intelligence and alchemical understanding that surpasses what typically passes for an homunculus in most texts. Again, more in common with Roger, who is very much an intelligent individual.
Well, I like the idea that these things are built and then they're effectively immortal, so they're hanging around for a long time and they're just absorbing knowledge like a sponge, so of course they'd be smart.
Yeah, if you let one live long enough.
So
homunculi are one of my favorite subjects. They're creepy, weird little goblinoids that are made by wizards. I mean, what's not to love?
Yeah, they're great.
It's an artificial humanoid created through alchemy, which, again, is that 16th through 18th century hodgepodge of occultist lore, superstition, and pre-scientific chemistry. So it's not quite a human. The creature is a rational animal, as it often was described, and another fictional page in humanity's dream of mastering life and death. But one of the cool things is that when you start getting into the text, of course, you get into any alchemical text, and there's all sorts of weirdness and absurdity, and as well as stuff that seems to be code for other secrets. It gets, very Byzantine.
Mm-hmm.
One that I was looking at in particular is the Book of the Cow, and it lays out some rather grotesque and confusing instructions in the art of do-it-yourself homunculi brewing. And, Makey van der Gluck's Abominable Mixtures, the Liber Vacae in the Medieval West, or The Dangers and Attractions of Natural Magic, really lays out some excellent commentary on what it all means.
That sounds like the kind of book that you would find at, Hogwarts Academy in the library.
Indeed. So I'm just going to briefly roll through, the recipe that is presented for the creation of homunculi. Do not attempt this at home. You can, but you're going to reach the point where the ingredients do not exist.
Mm.
So good luck with it. You're going to create one homunculi. You're going to need a magician's semen. Okay. You're going to need animal blood. You're going to need a cow. You're going to need some sulfur, a magnet. But here's where it starts getting complicated. First, a large glass or lead vessel. All right. That's going to be a little expensive.
Mm.
Then you're going to need green tutia. Which is a sulfite of iron.
Okay.
All right. You're going to have to hunt around for that. And oh yeah, you're going to need the sunstone, which is a mystical phosphorescent elixir.
This is always the case with alchemists, right? It's like, here's a bunch of like stuff that you put in this casserole. And then, oh yeah, you need this magical item that nobody knows where it is yet. Like a philosopher's stone.
Yeah. By the way, you're going to need the philosopher's stone or some other magical element that doesn't quite exist.
Right.
So you mix the semen and the sunstone, and you inseminate a cow.
Okay. Right?
And you carefully plug the animal up with the sunstone. You smear the animal with the blood of another animal. You place the artificially inseminated animal then inside a dark house where the sun never shines.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Then you feed the cow exclusively on the blood of another animal. Then you prepare a powder of the ground sunstone, sulfur, magnet, and green tutia, and then you stir with the sap of a white willow. Now, at this point, the text indicates that the cow should give birth and the resulting unformed substance should be placed in the powder that you just prepared, which will cause the amorphous blob to grow human skin. And then you have a newborn homunculus in a large glass or lead container, depending on which one you used, and the creature will become crazy hungry in this time, so you need to feed it the blood of its decapitated mother for 7 days, and in this time, it should develop into a fully grown, tiny, grotesque humanoid with some fragment of a human soul.
All right, I think I just got the idea for season 5 of Monster Science, how Dr. Anton Jessup can introduce the homunculus. You gotta do it like a cooking show.
Oh, yeah.
It's like as if a Guy Fieri is making a homunculus.
Oh, I bet he has. I bet he has made one before. The crazy thing, though, is that, you know, we get wrapped up in these ideas of like, the creation of life, you know, the Frankenstein myth that we discussed at length in our other episode this week. But the creation of the homunculi is not necessarily a means, you know, it's not necessarily the end product. The idea then is that you have, now that you have this homunculi, you're going to use it to create other things.
Right.
So you're essentially going to render it down and use it in other recipes. So in the text that I mentioned earlier, they say, quote, if it is placed on a white cloth with a mirror in its hands and suffumigated with a mixture of human blood and other ingredients, the moon will appear to be full on the last day of the month.
Well, right. That's useful, yeah. If you need to get around at night.
Like maybe you need that for another spell. I don't know. If it is decapitated and its blood is given to a man to drink, the man will assume the form of a bovine or a sheep.
Yeah.
But if he is anointed with it, he will have the form of an ape.
So this is like some Circe 101 stuff right here.
Now, this is where it starts getting potentially useful. If the homunculus is fed for 40 days in a dark house on a diet of blood and milk, and then its guts are extracted from its belly and rubbed onto someone's hands and feet, he may walk on water or travel around the world in the winking of an eye. Kept alive for a year and then placed in a bath of milk and rainwater, the homunculi will tell things that happen far away.
Now, that's your homunculi horror movie right there. Like, you base it around that premise, and then somebody stumbles across the dark house.
Yeah.
And they mess up this experiment.
It does create an even more horrific view of alchemy. Like, not only are they creating horrible little abominations, but then you're tormenting the abomination to pull off various other sorcerous schemes.
Oh, yeah. Well, it gets back to what we talked about in the Frankenstein episode, the ethics of creating life from nothing.
So, and as we discussed in that, like, we have this basic idea, you know, the basic human ability to imbue unliving things with life. You know, you paint a picture, and then that picture becomes the thing to a certain extent. So we kind of create homunculi every day, but it takes something like the true mythic homunculus, or SCP-30, to drive home just how weird that really is.
Mm. All right, so my next one is a far step from a homunculi, although, well, we just don't know, because this is SCP-51, which is cataloged as unknown, because no one knows what it is, and in fact, no one can remember that it even exists half the time. No one can describe what it is or its appearance. Somehow it erases any memory of itself from a subject's mind. They can't describe it. Even those who try to sketch a copy of a photograph are unable to remember what it looks like. Watching it on closed circuit cameras causes amnesia, and it's basically called the self-keeping secret. No one remembers how it was brought to SCP or who built its containment room. There's a lot in the file on it, on the containment unit and the very particular ways it has to be contained. But the most important thing is that all personnel have to stay at least 50 meters from the center of the room. Otherwise, they just forget that it exists.
Oh, I love this. It's very, it sounds like something Borges would have come up with. You know, it's a paradox. It's a thought experiment.
Even those who talk about it, just the act of talking about it, seem to forget that it existed shortly thereafter.
Huh.
Okay, so
what's the possible scientific tie-in here?
Well, we can look at amnesia or how to erase memories. And there are a lot of ways to erase human memories. And in fact, we're making a lot of headway with it right now in modern science. But let's do a quick look at amnesia. What is it? Well, it's a loss of memory from physical or psychological conditions. Usually we're talking about a head trauma, but sometimes disease or emotional trauma contributes to it as well. Now, given the circumstances of SCP-55, I'm assuming it has to do with emotional trauma. Like, it's so emotionally traumatizing to look at it or even talk about it or think about it that your brain just erases it. But I don't know.
Or it could also be reaching in with spores or something and physically manipulating your brain, right?
They don't mention any traces of physical signs, but that is possible as well. It could be a disease, or maybe it's some kind of physical manifestation that's localized to a 50-meter radius. I don't know. But SCP-55 doesn't seem to be causing what's known as anterograde amnesia, because people can form new memories. People with anterograde amnesia cannot form new memories.
Okay.
Retrograde amnesia seems to be what's going on here. That's when you're impeded from retrieving your previous memories. If it's any kind of psychogenic amnesia, then it could be dissociative, or it could be like a fugue state, possibly as a result of post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'm thinking, again, it's causing such emotional stress that people just completely forget about it. The reported symptoms, however, don't seem to indicate that the creation of a dissociative identity is going on here. So it's not like you go in and you see it and you create an entire identity while you're seeing it, and then you're unable to recall the memories of your identity that interacts with SCP-55. It's probably not a head trauma, like I was saying, because there'd be evidence, unless it's electric. But even electroconvulsive treatments usually lead to anterograde amnesia and not retrograde. So, okay, you could possibly treat this as memory loss with drugs that use active norepinephrine. But would the subject's recall immediately shut down their memories again? I don't know. What if they took the drugs, though? What if they took drugs that limited their perception skills while they were in contact with SCP-55? Ooh. So maybe then they'd be able to remember it? Not sure. I looked to an article called "Wiping the Slate: Is Playing with Memory Humane or Is It Just Wrong?" from Psychology Today. And it covers the broad spectrum of ways in which we're able to start erasing memories today. Scientists have been using behavioral conditioning and drugs that alter memory consolidation on the molecular level to erase memories. They can delete memories in rats, but we haven't really figured out how to target specific memories yet. And there's three ways that they're doing it. Propranolol is a beta blocker that they use, and it can weaken the link between the facts of a memory and its emotional impact by blocking adrenaline and other substances that ignite our fear response. Another possibility is zeta inhibitor peptides. So what happens with these is they inhibit our PKM zeta enzymes so that they can't maintain or strengthen long-term memories in our brains. So for instance, rats that are injected with this will walk right into shock-rigged obstacles that they've previously learned to avoid. The last one is that our amygdalas seem to be able to be overwritten by genetically disarmed herpes. It infiltrates and cripples the neural networks in a human brain, but the current human application seems very far-fetched to be able to, like, isolate specific memories such as SCP-55.
Well, SCP-55 could be an alien with some sort of space herpes.
Maybe. Yeah. Or maybe it's just emitting propranolol or zeta inhibitors. Who knows? Let's look a little bit more at this. We've talked about this on the show before, especially with relation to PTSD and the use of MDMA to treat it. Because PTSD memories remain horribly intense, they're considered a disease of how memory works, and in the sense that they can't be forgotten. So PTSD subjects are actually often counseled to share their memories to try to help in the act of forgetting, but this actually rarely seems to help. However, I will acknowledge through our MDMA episodes, that does seem to help them if they take MDMA and then they go through counseling. Because the MDMA helps them forget by associating those memories with trust and a lack of fear, as we've talked about in that. If you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend it, our two-parter on MDMA and the science behind it.
This would, you know, thinking of it, of this entity, the specimen, SPC-55, as a potential alien creature that emits some sort of psychoactive substance.
Yeah.
Clearly it's not emitting MDMA, but that would be a wonderful setup for some sort of science fiction. And maybe it's before. An alien just to be in its presence without like a containment suit is to know pure euphoria and bliss.
Right. It's like a, like using pheromone. Oh, you know what it's like? It's like, David Tennant's character on Jessica Jones.
Oh yeah.
It creates Mr. trust and the purple man, I believe, Kilgrave. It's like he's emitting, something that makes you trust him and have a lack of fear, total lack of fear. But I don't know if that's what's going on with SCP-55. Could be, memories themselves. Let's remember this. Nope. I didn't mean to do that as a pun. They're not packets of data. They're not constant. The very act of remembering changes a memory itself. This model has been shown at a molecular level by neuroscientists. So therefore, memories can be altered by other chemicals, specifically those that inhibit protein synthesis. So if new proteins can't be created during the act of remembering, the original memory ceases to exist. So maybe SCP-55 is suppressing protein creation.
Well, this would make sense because based on what I've covered in the past on potential memory erasure, like memories become susceptible to tweaking, to treating, or erasure when they are recalled. Like if I always think of memories as like a clay sculpture. It's in a drawer. And anytime you get it out, that's when you end up changing the shape with your hands just by remembering it. And then you put it back in the drawer. If it's in the drawer, it's harder to get to. But if you retrieve it, if you're retrieving the memory, if you're engaged with the memory, then it's susceptible.
Well, the thing about SCP-55 that makes it difficult to quantify this way is it's somehow mimetic, because even the very mention of it, like that somehow passes on this possible protein inhibition to other people. So they forget it too. Hmm. Like if you've never even encountered it and I tell you about it, you'll forget about it. So perhaps the act of speaking about it somehow is passing along the protein suppression. I don't know. Like you get infected with this protein suppression and then speaking passes that along to another person. Not sure what's going on. If you couple the drugs that I mentioned above, with what's known as reconsolidation memory therapy, you can get very specific about which memories you want to erase. In fact, if you inject a protein synthesis inhibitor in rats before they're exposed to reconsolidation, they can be trained to forget all their fear associations with something. So maybe what's going on is SCP-55 reconsolidates your memories about it while it's also emitting either protein inhibitors or one of these chemicals. It's basically providing you with therapy about it while you're interacting with it.
And depending on the ultimate nature of it, maybe this is a beneficial thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's like, I know I'm horrible and you can't really comprehend me without going mad, so I'm going to meet you halfway here.
Right. Here, I'll give you some drugs and I'll also talk you through it. In 2014, there was a study where a team at Ricken MIT's Center for Neural Circuit Genetics, they were able to alter bad memories in mice using something called optogenetics. They inserted genetically encoded light responsive proteins into cells so they could pinpoint where in the mouse's brain a negative memory was formed. Then they used lasers to manipulate the neurons in the mouse brain so it forgot that memory completely.
Oh.
Another team in 2014 used xenon gas as an anesthetic on mice to modify their memory consolidation, and that inhibited their NMDA receptor brain activity in their brains, again reducing fear reactions. So this is something that science is playing around with a lot right now, and every article I read about it was like, yeah, it's not eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, yada, yada, yada. But it seems like lasers, drugs, protein inhibitors, xenon gas, you name it. There are a lot of ways to biologically alter our brains so we forget things. So SCP-55 could be any combination of things that you could either use chemicals or lasers or whatever. I'm going to go, though, with that it causes such emotional trauma that you don't remember it. The big question is, how is it transmittable? Like, how does anybody out there, I'd love to know, how could something like this be a transmittable memory erasure?
How about this? Maybe it's not so much transmitted. What if this is this entity is something that has already been experienced by everyone? And therefore, it's not so much that you're introducing me to the idea of it, but you're reintroducing it. And any reintroduction to the specimen, either an actual encounter or just discussion of it, of course, ends up self-deleting. So like, what if it, you know, what if it's God?
Right.
And you see this God right before you're born.
Yeah.
And then you enter this world. So everyone has an existing memory. Or maybe if you want to go even more fanciful and psychedelic, like everyone has like a race memory of this entity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That would make sense as well. Well, it's currently under containment, although probably 30 seconds after Robert and I finish talking about this, we'll completely forget about SCP-55. We're going to talk about SCP-2584.
Yes, SCP-2584. And this one, like the last specimen we looked at, it's interesting because it represents a paradox. Here's the description. SCP-2584 is a species of snake that has been classified Oxyuranus ouroboros. SCP-2584 has no head or tail, as its body forms a continuous closed loop. Otherwise, SCP-2584's tissue and anatomy is completely normal, save for its circular spine, circulatory system, and digestive tract. SCP-2584 is able to achieve locomotion, but has no brain, sense of sight, hearing, taste, or smell, and thus is only capable of reflexive movements to flee from danger after injury or move towards warmer areas. Otherwise, instances tend to remain still or spin in place.
So I'm just imagining it's a circular snake body with no head, no tail, but when it moves, it's just kind of rolling around like a hula hoop on the ground.
Basically, yeah. Imagine a snake hula hoop.
Yeah.
And that's what this thing is. So the description goes on to state that it doesn't breathe. It depends on an unknown energy source.
Okay.
Again, it has no brain.
Yeah, because it can't eat.
Yeah. And its digestive tract seems to cycle the same matter continuously, but it's somehow able to gain metabolic energy with each cycle without expending any of the nutrients.
Hmm.
And it reproduces via osmosis into two hoops of an element.
Okay.
So what we have here is...
So they've actually got a room full of these things. It's not just one.
I guess, or at least they have, you know,
they have at least
on
one.
any given point. I don't know if they sell them in the SCP gift
Maybe
shop.
Maybe the SCP employees use them as hula hoops for their kids. They only keep one in the containment cell at a time.
Because they're kind of like tribbles, right?
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah.
They seem to have no... They lack the necessary openings, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no obvious reproductive capabilities.
Yeah. So what we have here, and why this is, I think, interesting, is that you basically have an imaginative sci-fi send-up of the mythical Ouroboros, the tail-consuming serpent, which has been a potent symbol since ancient times. I mean, you see examples of it from, Neolithic cultures. You see it in ancient Egypt. It basically emerged in ancient times as basically a symbol or a motif. And then as human culture advances, we end up applying all sorts of different reads to what it might mean.
Yeah.
Plutarch, for instance, when it came around to his time, he described it as like this. He said, quote, "It feeds upon its own body. Even so, all things spring from God and will be resolved into the deity again." So interpretations vary. They get increasingly more complex and spiritual. In Hinduism, Ouroboros symbolism is sometimes ties into Kundalini energy, the Kundalini serpent.
Right.
You see it in South American art. You see it in Gnostic beliefs. The Ouroboros is the soul of the world. It's so it goes from just being this idea, almost this kind of primitive childlike idea of like, what if a snake bit its own tail? What if a snake tried to eat its own tail? And then it evolves into this paradoxical idea of something without beginning or end.
Yeah, it's I've always thought of it as being both like a symbol of the circle of life, which I guess you could see SCP-2584 as being a perfect representation of.
Yeah.
But it's also like, representative of just like the quixotic nature of doing things over and over again and expecting different results.
Yeah, it's true. It kind of depends what your take on infinity is.
Yeah.
Cause you can look at the Ouroboros. Oh, that poor snake. It's constantly being eaten.
Yeah.
Or you can say, oh, that snake, he's really got it made. It always has a meal.
Yeah, he's never hungry.
Because it also never...
It's a glass half full kind of situation.
Because I guess you can look at it too and say that the Ouroboros never vanishes and the Ouroboros doesn't just blink out of existence because it cannot digest itself.
Hmm. Fun fact from our X-Files episode, Agent Scully has one tattoo and it is the Ouroboros.
Oh, where does she have the tattoo?
It's on the back of her neck, I think.
Okay.
And there's some implication that she may be immortal because she has it.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that again, there are ties to undying nature, as we saw in that Plutarch quote. You also see other sort of mythical and folkloric creatures that come up from time to time. There's the hoop snake, which was a creature from the lumberjack folklore of Wisconsin and Minnesota during the 19th and 20th century. The fearsome critters, as they were called. And this was a snake that would bite its own tail and roll around on the ground like a hula hoop.
Mm.
But we also see some interesting scientific examples. So you'll occasionally run across tales of auto-cannibalism in snakes, of snakes actually biting or trying to eat their tail, particularly when you're dealing with snakes in captivity. But you also have a few animals that engage in Ouroboros-like actions. So there's the South African armadillo girdled lizard that actually bites its own tail, curls up, and uses the bite to keep hold of its tail. So it's a beautiful little creature. It doesn't roll around like this, but it just uses it as a way to protect itself. But it does bite onto its own tail.
Yeah, it like maximizes its defensive capabilities.
Yeah, and then you'll find other lizards and animals that curl up and sometimes even roll, but don't actually bite onto their tail. For instance, Mount Lyell salamanders, they'll curl up and roll downhill, but there's no biting.
Okay.
But back to the specimen here. So it becomes difficult to try and imagine how this creature could actually exist, right?
Yeah.
Because it's an impossibility. It's a self-sustaining system, a perpetual motion machine. And of course, perpetual motion machines cannot exist because of friction and energy dissipation. Like you can't make a machine that will work forever without having some energy input coming along and charging it back up again. Likewise, even if you took out breathing concerns, lack of a brain, if you just had this hoop snake creature, this specimen, and it had a meal in its belly going round and round, like how it couldn't draw on that meal forever. I mean, even if it were an everlasting gobstopper, right? It could not sustain itself unless the meal in its belly was like a wormhole opening up to a food world. But no, these are similar questions. Like, you can't have the same meal digested eternally. It's going to break down. They're diminishing returns. And likewise, SCP-2584, if it just has that one thing in its belly, it's not, I mean, how would that possibly work?
Yeah. Some kind of food is being teleported into its belly from somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. We're faced with,
maybe another SCP is responsible for this.
There you go. If there is some sort of an SCP mouse that is eternally regenerating, perhaps through a wormhole.
Yeah.
Then this creature eats it at some point. But then how does it eat? It doesn't have a mouth. It would have, that's the wonderful nature of it. It's just a complete paradox.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's certainly worth thinking about as an exercise in understanding, anatomy and definitely energy consumption too. That's for sure.
I guess the only answer I can get for SCP-2584 is that it might be God. To go back to Plutarch, this might be a manifestation of the mystery of the divine.
Hmm. That is worth chewing on. Literally. I wonder what SCP-2584 tastes like. Chicken, probably.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the ethics of science, That leads us to our last SCP specimen, 231, which is referred to as Special Personnel Requirements. I really like this one because it leads us to talking about the Milgram experiment and a lot about the ethics and sort of point of scientific experimentation. Here's the description of SCP-231. It's a girl, possibly a baby, that has to be subjected to something called the Montauk procedure. Now, we're never told what the details of this are, but it sounds awful. Most of the detail in the description goes into the requirements for the personnel that are attending to SCP-231. They have to undergo heavy psychological testing. They have to be unmarried, have no children, and express total loyalty to the SCP. And if they express any sympathy to the subject, they are immediately transferred off the project. When they're on site, they wear helmets to conceal their identity and voice. And basically, SCP-231, whatever it is strapped down all the time, except for when they're subjected to this horrible procedure, once every 24 hours. The subject doesn't actually seem to be that important to the entry. The story goes that they're the seventh child born out of some kind of cult organization, that the first six subjects were its siblings, and they were killed in various results from this procedure, the containment, this Montauk procedure. The personnel that work on this are told that if they don't subject SCP-231 to this horrible Montauk procedure, it will result in the end of the world. So some of the personnel also have their memories altered, maybe by SCP-55, we're not sure, but they basically forget that they ever performed their duties in relation to this project. This, pop culture-wise, immediately made me think of Stranger Things. Now, I don't want to spoil Stranger Things at all, but, you know, the original, title for the show was Montauk.
Huh.
So I wonder, I don't know which came first, SCP-231 or the TV show, or maybe they're somehow connected. Like maybe the anonymous author is one of the people behind Stranger Things. But, yeah, the show was originally called Montauk, and, the idea of this secret project that's working, you know, doing terrible, unethical things to a girl. It's interesting. It brings us right around to the Milgram experiment. And the reason why is one of the things they say about this SCP is that all of the personnel have to pass the Milgram experiment, meaning that they have to take it all the way. If you are unfamiliar with the Milgram experiment, it is one of the most controversial and highly publicized psychological studies ever conducted, I would say.
Yeah, it's definitely up there. We've touched on it in past episodes before. Anytime you see a list of like the weirdest, most unethical experiments, it tends to show up right at the top.
Yeah. So if you've never heard of it, this is how it goes. It was performed in 1961 and 1962, and it was designed to measure the extent to which ordinary people would inflict pain on other people when they are instructed to do so by an authoritative figure. It was very controversial because the people were put in these situations without informed consent. And it was influenced by accounts Milgram heard of Nazi atrocities. He wanted to measure how willing the average person would be to obey institutionalized authority. And he actually received a grant from the National Science Foundation to do this, conducted the experiments at Yale from 61 to 62. Now, you may have heard of this in relation to the phrase, the banality of evil. It's often attributed to this study, but it was actually coined by Hannah Arendt in her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem. She was reporting on Adolf Eichmann's trial in 1961. Eichmann was a Nazi commander who helped orchestrate the Holocaust. Now, Arendt's theory was that Eichmann wasn't a sociopath. He was just an average person following orders. Milgram speaks to these ideas in his book, Obedience to Authority, which is sort of the publication of his results. But he published it much later, I want to say like 10 years later.
So basically the question raised by the experiment is, could basically any of us be a part of some atrocity chain if we were just in the position to receive those orders?
Exactly. And this is how the experiment worked. There were three people in each situation, a supervisor, a learner, and a teacher. However, The only subject that was actually under scrutiny was the teacher. The other two people were just actors. The teacher was uninformed about the true nature of the experiment, and the supervisor would tell them that what they were doing was determining whether punishment in the form of electric shocks would promote learning. So usually the person playing the role of the learner was in another room, and the teacher was seated in front of an apparatus that would pretend to shock the learner with somewhere between 15 and 450 volts. The teacher was then instructed to give a long, multiple choice test to the learner. And every time they had an incorrect answer, the teacher was supposed to administer the shock, upping the voltage 15 volts each time. No one was actually shocked in this experiment. The learner just pretended that they were being shocked until it reached 315 volts. They would scream and, you know, pretend like they were in agony. At 315 volts, though, they would just stop making sounds. Like, presumably they passed out or something. And I think a lot of these instances, they were in a separate room and they couldn't see each other.
Right.
If the learner refused, the experiment stopped. But the supervisor usually would direct them to just keep continuing. Otherwise, they would keep going until they reached 450 volts. Now, let's be clear. The truth was always revealed to the teacher afterwards. They always told them what was actually going on. And the results were as such. 65% of the participants kept going all the way to 450 volts. None of them insisted on stopping before 300 volts. Whether or not Milgram used women or men in this experiment did not change the results, but when the physical proximity increased, the obedience factor decreased slightly, meaning when the teacher and the learner were closer to each other, they were less likely to go all the way with the shocks. This one is where it gets really scary. When a teacher was joined by actors posing as other teachers, their conformity rose all the way to 90%.
Oh, wow.
So, okay, the reason why we all know about this experiment is it's been highly criticized for its ethics, specifically that it did not supply the subjects with informed consent, and it exposed them to overly stressful and embarrassing situations. Milgram, however, defended it, and he said, look, we've got this survey. It's an exit survey that we do with everybody that's done it. 84% of those people were glad to have participated. Some of them even said by doing the experiment, it made them more ethically sensitive. Now, we talked about this in the Frankenstein episode. We were sort of pretending, what if Frankenstein had to apply for an IRB? This is one of those studies that led to the Belmont report and having to have IRB approval before you do any kind of scientific experiment in an institutional setting.
Yeah, because you don't want to conduct an experiment that is putting people through the emotional ringer.
Yeah.
Unless there's, you know, full, you know, knowledge of it going in, which is part of the experiment, is that they did not have that knowledge.
Exactly. This is why the American Psychological Association formulated its principles for research with humans. This is why it requires all research to receive approval by IRBs. In fact, an IRB did approve social psychologist Jerry M. Berger to obtain permission to partially replicate the experiment, but he stopped at 150 volts when the actor began to scream. However, his results up until that point were similar to Milgram's. So this is something that's worth considering. And in fact, I once upon a time pitched a show here at How Stuff Works that would be entirely about studies like this. This study could never be done legally today, and that's a good thing. I think we can all agree on that. And yet, it is incredibly influential on our understanding of human psychology. Our overall knowledge of things has improved, I think you could say, based on this study. So what other lessons have we learned from unethical science? And what lessons are we missing? And then, let's get back to this SCP, like, what is it ultimately about? I don't think it's about the girl. It's more about the personnel, right? It's about the horror that is this great social significance of what human beings are capable of.
Well, and supposedly they're saving the world.
Yeah, exactly. This, right? That's what they're told. Yeah, yeah. And that's where it gets really interesting. There's a couple studies here I want to get into. I have two studies I want to talk about that are related to Milgram that have recently been published. The first is called Why People Kill, and it was published in the Chronicle of Higher Education. It reminds us as well of another infamous case, the Stanford Prison Experiment in 1971. Yeah. If you're unfamiliar with that one, psychologist Philip G. Zimbardo randomly assigned Stanford University students to play roles as prisoners and guards. Within days, the people who were playing guards were abusing the prisoners. The prisoners themselves became passive. The study actually had to be called off. There's another study as well that I was unfamiliar with that's referenced in here. Muzaffar Sharif's 1954 study on how competition can escalate into conflict. He divided adolescent boys into two teams and he pitted them against each other at certain tasks. It also had to be called off because violence started between the boys. So what's going on here? Why are we circling around back to these projects? Because it feels like this, and this is the argument of this paper, it feels like we're at a time where we're very concerned about violence and the possibility that good people will do bad things, right? So think of the presidential election right now and like the rhetoric that's being tossed around about what people are capable of and how we have to defend ourselves against them. So this kind of stuff is in the air. People are thinking about it a lot. There's very apocalyptic thoughts in people's minds about what we're all capable of doing to one another.
Oh, I would say that that is generally more of the like the standard human experience, and just in this country and in other countries we've just been lucky to not have that be in our conscious as often.
I think you're probably right. Yeah, it's only now that we're having to come to grips with this reality. The studies themselves presume that people aren't born bad necessarily, but that we're all coerced or seduced or otherwise led into violent behavior. Now, the author of this article, not Milgram, but the author of this one, he argues this is out of date thinking, as well as the idea of any kind of pure nature oriented view. So that's worth thinking about in conjunction with this SCP. I want to give you a Milgram quote, though, to pause and sort of think about here. Milgram himself said, "Ordinary people, simply doing their jobs and without any particular hostility on their part, can become agents in a terrible destructive process. Moreover, even when the destructive effects of their work become patently clear and they are asked to carry out actions incompatible with the fundamental standards of morality, relatively few people have the resources needed to resist authority." That's really interesting to think about. I mean, think about it not just from this level of like Nazis committing atrocities, but like your jobs. Like think about the like hierarchical structure in a job workplace or whatever.
And yeah, like, because it's one thing to imagine Nazis and have your idea colored by all these storybook portrayals of Nazis.
Yeah.
And you can easily think, oh, I would stand up for that. I would be one of the good people. But yeah, think of all the smaller,
mundane actions of authority. Yeah. Yeah. It's really worth thinking about. And that brought me to, this article called Just Obeying Orders out of New Scientist. It was published in 2014. And they took the point, they said, Milgram later developed his idea of a mundane inclination to obey orders of authority into something he called agentic state theory. This was in his 1974 book, Obedience to Authority, the same one where he talks about Hannah Arendt's banality of evil. And according to Milgram, the essence of obedience consists in the fact that a person comes to view themselves as the instrument for carrying out another person's wishes, and they therefore no longer see themselves as responsible for their actions. Once this critical shift of viewpoint has occurred in a person, all of the essential features of obedience follow. So when you go back to this SCP, right, we've got this, I don't know, cultist child strapped down to a gurney and she has to be tortured with the Montauk experiment once a day. Basically gets back to it that the reason why is because the personnel are all willing to shift viewpoints like this, right?
Yeah.
Now, the authors of this article in New Scientist, they argue against Milgram's theory, actually, and they cite recent historical studies that question Arendt's interpretation of Eichmann, as well as Milgram's claim that human beings are programmed to obey authority. And I just want to pause here for a second. I never took that to be his claim. I always thought that the fact that they recognize that he saw these as studies as disobedience as much as obedience. His argument to me doesn't seem to be deterministic about human nature, right? That, I mean, he makes the point like at least 10% of people, even when there's these actors involved, are going to disobey authority, right? So it's not necessarily like he's saying this is it. This is exactly what humanity is.
No, yeah, he's saying, I mean, there is a silver lining in that a certain percentage of individuals would seemingly always stand up to some sort of injustice like this.
Yeah.
I guess the depressing part is when you have to ask, well, is that percentage high enough to make a difference in even a very democratic process, much less, you know, the inner workings of a shadowy organization that tends to weird alien specimens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's why I love this one. It's like, you know, when you really think about it beyond just like, you know, the idea of this mysterious cultist with an experiment performed against their will every 24 hours, there's like a lot of meat on the bone, like ethically, thematically, going on with just this short little creepypasta.
Yeah, and asking basic ethical questions. Is saving the world worth this one individual injustice?
Yeah.
Do the rights of all outweigh the rights of one?
Well, let's factor this in, because I think this is where it gets even more complicated. Haslam and Riker, the authors of this study from 2014, they argue what's really going on is a balance between obedience and disobedience that's based on whether or not the person in the teacher role prioritizes the voice of the supervisor over the voice of the learner. And to them, this reflects whether the person identifies with the cause of science or more with the plight of the ordinary citizen. So this is really interesting to me. It's like it puts them in one of two camps, right? In this case with the SCP, that this science is going to save the world, right? Uh-huh. At least that's what they're told. Or the plight of this ordinary girl who's being tortured by the Montauk experiment. In which case, if that's it, the orders position the experiment as being a worthy cause that must be pursued. So the level of identification between the supervisor and the learner is really important, but so too is how much they identify with the cause of capital S science. It's very interesting, especially like, I think from our show's sort of, viewpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what ultimately is driving the research and the researchers, this idea that science is this thing beyond us, and then we're just mere vessels for this inquisitive nature? Or are we individuals engaging in a collective effort to better the human experience and human knowledge?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that this is one of those things that like we can pull out, and it's applicable to almost every episode we've done, right? Like, what's the goal of this project? What's the reason? Are we doing this for science's sake? It brings us back to cargo cult science, right?
Yeah.
Or is it, you know, is it somehow affecting the ordinary man somehow? So to this end, these authors did three studies. In one, they used virtual reality to replicate Milgram's setup. In another, they asked people to describe groups of other people using pejorative terms. And this ranged from the KKK to a family walking in the park. In their final study, they had actors perform all of Milgram's setup. So even the teacher role was performed by an actor. And they recorded the reactions as if the actors were inhabiting these characters. And they found, once again, Milgram's results were almost exactly reproduced with these actors. So they basically found an increase in identification with science leads people to persist longer in these unpleasant tasks. And the last thing I want to say about this, there's a researcher named Matthew Hollander, and he took the audio tapes from Milgram's study, and he researched all of them. He listened to the whole thing, like a year and a half worth of these studies. And he identified six types of resistance that were shown by the people involved with them, three of which were implicit and three were explicit. The implicit ones were silence or hesitation, imprecations, or laughter. And some people who have listened to these tapes, they interpret the laughter as being sadism. But he said, no, the laughter is just this like uncomfortability of obeying the orders. The explicit ones were when they addressed the learner and they would say things like, are you sure you want me to continue with this? Or when they prompted the supervisor and would say, is it really necessary for me to continue doing this? And the last one was when they would just stop and they'd say, look, I'm not going to continue doing this. I'm done. Here's the really interesting thing from his study. Those who participated all the way to the end, the 450 volts, they all used the implicit strategies, the silence, laughter, etc. The participants who actually addressed the learners and tried to have a dialogue with them, they were the only people who stopped in Milgram's experiment. Hmm. So that speaks something to our, again, the identification. Do you identify with the person or do you identify with the cause, right?
Yeah, and to what degree is there going to be any kind of back and forth communication over any of this? Or is it just becoming a vessel for the orders?
So this is, to wrap it up, my one of my favorite creepypastas I've ever looked at. Whoever out there wrote it anonymously, bravo. It really made me think pretty deeply about the ethics of what the goals of science are, not just in terms of like, you know, the fact-based stuff of like, well, I got to fill out this IRB protocol, you know, but more along the lines of like, what's the point and what are we willing to do to get to it?
Yeah. And I think in this is another example of how SCP Foundation entries are kind of an evolution of the form. So instead of them just being like individual creepy bits of, you know, semi-wiki type material, they are little thought experiments, little paradoxes, that are flavored with sci-fi intrigue. And so, I would definitely recommend anyone who found these interesting to check out that website. We'll include links on the landing page for this episode of StuffToBlowYourMind.com to the individual entries that we profiled here.
Yeah.
So check those out, explore some more. And if you find some, then you think to yourself, oh, well, these were perfect. If you guys do another SCP episode, you should do these. You should let us know about that.
Yeah, definitely. Keep the messages coming about creepypastas. We, you know, if you keep wanting to hear them, we'll keep doing them. So let us know. Maybe it's an SCP, maybe it's another creepypasta, but point out stuff to us and we'll look into it. And maybe Creepypasta 4, The Revenge, will be coming up down the road. So if you want to reach out to us, well, some of the best ways are to just go to StuffToBlowYourMind.com. That's where we've got all our articles, our videos, our podcasts, as well as links to all of our social media.
Yeah, and if you're listening during Halloween, we also have the new episodes of Monster Science there for you. Explorations of the connections between fictional monsters and real-world science.
Yeah, absolutely. I highly recommend Monster Science. My favorite thing that we do here at How Stuff Works. This is a treat to me. This is my Christmas. So if you want to write us the old-fashioned way, though, and you want to tell us about creepypastas, maybe praise Robert for his performance in Monster Science, or you've got some experiments that you'd like us to conduct, you can always write to us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.